May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Donna Coltharp. I represent Mr. Ebron in this case today. I'd also like to introduce you to my boss, Henry Bemperoud, who is sitting at council table with me. As you know, Mr. Ebron has raised several issues in this case, addressing both his convictions and his sentence. I'm going to start off by addressing the dismissal of the holdout juror, Brittany Johnson, and then we'll see where we go from there. When a district court has heard both claims from other jurors that a juror is engaging in misconduct and evidence that the juror in question has doubts about the case, evidence-based doubts about the case, the district court has to act very carefully to protect the defendant's Sixth Amendment rights. As you know from reading the briefing, five circuit courts have held that the test that most protects both the defendant's rights and the integrity of jury deliberations, and I would also argue public confidence in a jury verdict, is the no reasonable possibility test. The 11th Circuit calls it the no substantial possibility test, but the 11th Circuit also says that the tests are more or less the same. By substantial, the 11th Circuit means tangible, not speculative.
But the cases have fleshed out differently. The no possibility test has principally been articulated in cases which have involved jury nullification or issues in which it otherwise might be required to what I call delve into the cognitive processes of a juror. None of those cases have abrogated our general view that the trial court has broad discretion in terms of handling the trial court, et cetera. And so you'll need to help me at least, or us, and where you see this reasonable possibility test fitting in the continuum of our circuit law, the law in Edwards, et cetera, or whether you're arguing that none of those apply and that we should be articulating some new test or different test for this case.
Let me start at the end and work back. I think that what I'm asking for is consistent with this court's precedent, although this court has not specifically applied this test. As for the circuit cases that are out there, I think two of them, maybe three, deal with jury nullification. One of them is a bias case. And I think what is important when you look at the reasoning of those decisions is the reasoning for the test is not tied so much to the justifications for dismissal as it is to the information that the district court learns when he or she is investigating the claims. So yes, there has been some conversation about how this test applies in a nullification case or in a bias case, because those are very problematic claims. And those claims are a lot of the times they're going to get into juror deliberations. That doesn't mean that a lack of candor claim could never take the court into jury deliberations. In fact, if you look at Edwards, in Edwards, the jurors came to the court and said, we have two problems with this jury. One of them is he's bringing in extrinsic evidence. The other one is we think he's biased. This court was very careful to point out that the district court in Edwards did not pursue the bias inquiry. It only pursued the extrinsic evidence inquiry. And the reason the court did that, or at least the reason this court was able to affirm the court's decision to dismiss the juror, is the extrinsic evidence inquiry enabled the court to talk to the jurors without finding out whether the problem juror had problems with the evidence.
But in the Edwards case, I mean, Judge Polizzola had a string of situations, I mean, that didn't go to the cognitive processes, as I would say it. I mean, the juror number 68 had presented themselves with several factors. I mean, there were at least three occasions in which Judge Polizzola, even when the information was brought to him, did not press the button of inquiring further. It's only until you get to the, say, third level of matters brought to the attention that then the judge goes further. And so in it, clear error gives three different bases: extrinsic evidence, lack of candor, failed to answer the judge's question, still had the written note. I mean, all of those that don't require going to cognitive processes. So our panel said, with us within the general discretion of the court. So explain to me within that fabric what's systemically different in this case that that shouldn't be the analytical model for deciding the case as opposed to reasonable possibility?
I think Edwards is the beginning. I think Edwards gives you the start for your analytical inquiry, and I think everything that you just said is exactly why this case is different. That the district court may have started asking the jurors questions because it did get to that third level. Oh, we had had complaints about extrinsic evidence, we had had complaints about other sort of discrete conduct, but now we have a bias complaint, and now the district court's concerned. That's fine. I don't think what motivates the court to begin the inquiry is the question. The question is, what has the court learned during the course of those of that inquiry? I don't want to tie the district court's hands. The district court, in this case, had a terrible problem, and she had a lot of options available to her. But once she chose an option, and once the jurors started saying things to her like, she doesn't believe that certain facts are true, she says that she believes one witness over another, she plays the devil's advocate. We say one thing and she says, but you don't know that for a fact.
But what, the juror herself is the one who brought this problem to the attention of Judge Cronin. So, I mean, from day one, it was a valid investigation into why additional extrinsic information is being presented.
That it would be
what her attitude was, what the problem was in the hall.
It would be an extreme, well, number one, the district court didn't respond to her note. She asked the juror to go back into her jury room, which I think was an appropriate response. And notably, that's precisely what Johnson did. She went back into the courtroom. Secondly, Johnson's note was that she felt that other jurors were harassing her because of her opinion. Let's be clear, that claim was never investigated. If it was Johnson's note that prompted this inquiry, then there ought at least to have been some inquiry into whether the other jurors were trying to put pressure on her to change her opinion. She said that voices had been raised and later said that people had sworn at her, and she didn't feel comfortable going back into the jury room. Three jurors during voir dire misunderstood the district court's question and referred to that incident, and it was never followed up on. The district court never pursued whether, in fact, there was pressure, and I'm not saying evil or malign pressure. It could have been very understandable pressure, but whether there was pressure being brought to bear on this juror. And if there was, if there were swear words, if someone did raise their voice about this juror's opinions, that was a violation of their instructions.
But most of their complaints went to the fact that she would no longer deliberate, which is a violation of your oath.
She didn't take an oath to keep, well, again, several answers. First of all, she did not take an oath to keep deliberating after she had made up her mind. In fact, the instructions told her that she was entitled to make up her mind and that she was entitled to hold on to that opinion. In fact, she was required to. I think the evidence shows that, in fact, that jury was deliberating, including Johnson. And again, you go to the very jurors who this district court credited. Their responses were, I don't think she's deliberating. When we say X or Y, she says, you don't know that for a fact. That's deliberating. That's saying that the government has not met its beyond a reasonable doubt burden. Juror number 7, when he mistook the court's question and ended up talking a little bit about the yelling incident, said, well, we did kind of raise our voices at her. Why did they raise their voices at her? Because she wouldn't agree with them about what certain facts meant. So, in fact, there was some evidence, certainly, from these jurors that several of them believed that this juror was having problems because of her bias. There was no evidence, for example, in the 11th Circuit cases, the 11th Circuit has done a great job with the standard, by the way. Abel and Augustine were both affirmances of the district court's decision to dismiss the jury, and they're just fantastically reasoned opinions. In both of those cases, the juror who ended up getting dismissed said, I don't believe in the law. I will not follow the court's instructions. I don't think I have to do what the court says I have to do. In the in footnote 18 of Abel, the 11th Circuit makes a point to say, in this particular case, we are not crediting jurors' mere perceptions of bias. We are crediting the objective fact that this juror said she would not follow the law. In this case, you have, oh, I have a cheat sheet somewhere. You have.
Well, what are you going to do with the juror bringing in extrinsic information? I mean, you know.
Let's talk about the lawyer.
The juror brings in extrinsic information, and all of which, what you're saying, is all the more reason why, you know, every case is different.
Yes,
you've got to give the trial court discretion in a dynamic situation with these emerging facts to be able to make an on-the-site call. This is not in a vacuum where all we have is this bias, as Judge Clement says. You know, this emerges from the mouth of the juror herself in terms of his first ruminations. But what's your take on this extraneous information about the defense counsel and her record in getting people off in death cases?
Because of the way this case laid out, because the court decided to pursue both the bias allegations and the allegations of lack of candor, I think the test still applies. In other words, the reason for the test is what information has the district court learned. Edwards, the district court separated the inquiries. It only went into the extrinsic evidence inquiry. The district court in this case decided to pursue both inquiries simultaneously. And I think this case is a really good case for saying why that should be. If you look at the record, first of all, three jurors answered the question or said, juror number three actually volunteered it, that the statement had been made about Attorney Scardino. The foreperson didn't bring it up until the second interview when it was clear that one juror was going to be the focus of this investigation. It was juror number three who also mentioned it. Juror number three said, this statement took place before jury deliberations. Before jury deliberations, nobody said anything about this juror being biased or not following her instructions until there was a deadlock. And finally, I really do have to point out that there is not a good record on credibility on this claim. The court asked Ms. Scardino whether she had made any personal comments about the parties in the case. She said no. I think that's an honest answer to that question. And to say that it wasn't an honest answer to that question, that really requires her to be able to read the district court's mind as to what she was being asked. I frankly think, and this is, again, is the court's discretion, but I think that once she had decided to go down this path, she would have been better served to ask more specific questions of Ms. Scardino. Ms. Scardino was really not ever given an adequate opportunity to defend herself against the other jurors' views. And finally,
Let me make sure I understand. When you talk about lack of candor, are you clear that the district judge made a finding that she was less than candid about having made statements about defense counsel in the presence of the other members of the jury?
Yes.
Was that his finding?
That was her
finding. That's what she,
yes.
Her finding.
Let me be clear. Her oral findings were that she had, in fact, brought in the extrinsic information and that she was biased. Her written findings, which were after our motion for mistrial, in those findings, she used the reasoning in Edwards. In other words, it's a little bit of a stretch.
I want to deal with the facts.
Yes, she made that finding.
Did the judge say she was less than candid?
She did.
When I asked her if she had made any statements, so the judge said she was dishonest because I asked her if she'd made any statements about anybody in the case, and she said no to me.
She did. While the U.S. attorney.
That's her finding on lack of candor.
Yes. Her finding is that she was not candid. It's possible the written order could be more specific. It's possible that lack of candor goes to both. It goes to bias and to the statement about Ms. Scardino. But there is a lack of candor finding on the statement about Scardino. Yes. Yes. And I wanted to address the final question, what you had to say about judicial discretion. I think that's really important. There's been a lot of briefing in this case. We've made a lot of arguments, but I think it boils down to this. Nobody wants to hamstring the district court's hands. The district court is, exactly as you said, evolving situation, very difficult, long trial, all kinds of voices coming at the district court. Nobody wants to hamstring her hands. All we're arguing is that when she finds out that the juror that she's been investigating doubts the government's case based on the evidence, her discretion is narrowed. That's it. How she can respond.
And in that connection, you're conceding that whatever the trigger is for the judge's launching of the investigation is immaterial.
Absolutely.
So somebody can come in and say almost anything about another juror, and the judge can go right into an investigation.
I am not pleased that this court...
And you don't have any problem with
it. I am not pleased that this court did not pursue Johnson's claims of her being harassed. If I was a juror, I would want a court to do that. However, I concede the district court had the decision, had the discretion to decide when and why she was going to investigate. For that matter, she had the discretion to ask questions that would have elicited answers that got into the jury deliberations.
Well, do you acknowledge then that if the judge is upon the inquiry and there are, let's say, more volatile bases upon which inquiry might be made, and there are less volatile ones, and if in the less volatile ones, the judge views that there's objective factors and reasons for which this person should go for cause, that's what I'm going with.
That's Edward.
And if not reversible error, that I didn't go into these more volatile areas.
And, Your Honor, that's precisely, that's why this court's precedent does not hurt this case at all. That's precisely what this court held in Edwards. It's what this court held in Huntress, a case that involved mental illness, where the district court in that case may actually have had some information about deliberations. But there's no way that a district court or this court would have found that the judge in Huntress, that the juror's problems in Huntress stemmed from anything but his mental illness. This court has another case called Leahy. I believe Judge Benavides wrote that opinion involving a hearing impairment.
Well, help me. Then why is it reversible error if in the backdrop of that, which you're not asking us to overrule that, we couldn't anyway, but if the judge rules, makes the findings that she does, I mean, I'm still trying to find the reversible error.
If the judge has information that suggests to her that what's happening in the jury room is because a majority of jurors disagree with one juror and want her off, then the judge can't dismiss the jury because the judge...
Well, could the judge dismiss the juror for lack of candor?
Not in this case. In another case where the judge did not have information, absolutely. But in this case, for two reasons, the judge cannot dismiss the juror for lack of candor. The first reason is there was reason to believe that the lack of candor allegation also stemmed from disagreement. For example, it didn't happen, the comment didn't happen, it happened at trial, not in deliberation.
Well, that's a credibility determination then, isn't it?
Well, and that's my second point. Credibility, it seems to me, requires two parties. And Ms. Johnson wasn't asked whether she had made that statement, at least not clearly. And a third thing I want to point out.
So your argument in that connection is just with the form of the question by the judge. Judge didn't ask a precise enough question.
One component of my lack of candor argument is that Brittany Johnson was not given a chance to answer that question fairly. Yes. She wasn't given a chance to fairly answer that question.
All right, let me ask you to, because I'm assuming you're going to argue more than this point. Are you?
I'm happy to argue this point for my entire time.
Well, I want you to go somewhere else in a moment.
Okay.
I want you to succinctly, with not too many commas and what appeared at the end, tell me what it is you're articulating that this panel should hold with respect to this juror. Now remember, not too many commas nor a semicolon.
I'm sorry. I will try.
All right.
When there is evidence both of evidence-based disagreement and misconduct, before dismissing, the district court has to inquire whether there's a reasonable possibility that the problems stem from the evidence-based disagreement. The district court does not have to so find. It has to inquire. In other words, we don't always have to win that argument, but the district court has to inquire and make the finding for this court to review under an abuse of discretion standard.
All right. We got you on tape. We'll look at that. I want to shift you because there are a whole bunch of issues, but
there are.
I at least want to ask you about this argument that was made about that's in what I call the sentencing phase, selection phase, the testimony of Mr. Zeidenberg. Mm-hmm. And that evidence that was put on. That's in the penalty phase, et cetera. And as I understood it, the defense counsel's objection to it was based on relevance.
That's right.
and that's the argument you're making on appeal?
Yes, sir. I think it's not relevant to Ebron's specific motive for committing this offense. Mr. Barnes's concerns were really upsetting to anybody who read them, and I don't want to dismiss them at all, but they don't address my client. And more than that, the prosecutor admitted when we objected to the evidence that the jury had plenty of motive evidence before it, that there was no doubt what the motive for this offense was. Certainly, although Mr. Ebron argued that he did not have a specific motive to retaliate, no defense counsel nor Mr. Ebron ever contested that this was a informant-based murder and that that's why Mr. Barnes was murdered. That was never a contest at this trial. The testimony was completely unnecessary. It was the most emotional testimony offered at sentencing, and it was improper, I think, to let the jury hear it. And the government has now suggested that it can come in for victim impact. Of course, we got no notice of victim impact. Defense counsel in capital cases has a fairly standard way of responding to victim impact testimony. They go out, it's not a pleasant job, but they go out and they look for contrary information about the victim that they might rebut that testimony with. We had no opportunity to do that.
Well, let's presume it's too late for victim impact.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't this testimony, this emotional testimony, have been of some benefit to your client? Seems like it could have gone either way.
I'm sorry. Maybe I've just been thinking about this case too much. Tell me what the benefit is.
Well, I don't answer questions, but...
I'm sorry. Well, okay, then let me answer the question. I actually don't see a benefit right now to that evidence. I think when you're reading through the record, it's a fairly clean record that is extremely emotional, painful testimony to hear. And I can't imagine that it would have helped Mr. Ebron, and certainly defense counsel at trial.
It didn't read as extremely emotional. Read as an explanation of his position.
Right.
I
thought it was fairly emotional.
Well, let's look at it this way. Let's assume we agree it was there. Why wasn't it harmless?
It wasn't harmless because I think for the reasons that I just said. Even Mr. Ebron.
Because it was emotional?
Because it invited the juror to punish Mr. Ebron in an extreme way for the facts of being a DC crew member and not for his specific content, for the fear that Mr. Barnes felt rather than for this specific offense.
Well, part of the prosecution theory was that Mr. Ebron was involved in the homicide, holding the guy, et cetera, and all of it's tied to this DC snitch pattern. And so part of that evidence was put on in the case in chief, that being the theory. And I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Ebron's position was he was present, but he didn't know a homicide was going to occur or something to that effect.
Yes.
So the quality of this evidence is already before the jury in the case in chief in terms of the government's theory of his involvement, right?
The substance of the information is before the jury. That's exactly right.
On this aggravating factor, under the statute, previous conviction of offenses for which a sentence of death or life imprisonment was authorized, heinous, cruel, and depraved manner of committing the offense, substantial planning and premeditation, as I understand it, those were the notice provisions that were given.
Yes.
And the evidence the jury had is the guy was stabbed 106 times.
Yes.
And it's alleged that Mr. Ebron held him, et cetera, et cetera. So in this grand scheme of it, the trial judge made a determination. Her words was that it was tangentially relevant.
Right.
So that's the basis upon which it came. And I just wanted to be sure that we had your argument. You're still arguing that it wasn't relevant. I noticed you devote half of a line in the brief saying it's not only relevant, but it also was prejudicial. But prejudicial was not what was argued to the trial judge below as part of the 103 inquiry, which says, yes, it's probative, but still ought not to come in. But that wasn't argued to the district court in the transcript I read.
I think that's right.
So the district court did not really respond in terms of the inflammatory or not inquiry, and it's about a half of a sentence in the brief in terms of that,
right,
that piece. All right. Well, we have your argument on the record. You've saved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your responses. All right. We'll hear from the government. Ms. Kenner.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel. Before I move to the issues, Your Honor, I would like to introduce my co-counsel, Joe Beatty, who was the lead prosecutor in this case. Whenever we have an allegation of prosecutorial misconduct, our office takes it very seriously. And Mr. Beatty wanted to be here today to address any questions that the court might have about that. The court didn't raise any questions with the appellant on that issue, but Mr. Beatty will be prepared to address it. He also is prepared to address the questions regarding Mr. Zeidenberg's testimony. I will address the other issues in the case and we'll move directly to the issue regarding the dismissal of the juror. This court has consistently held that even a holdout juror may be dismissed for misconduct, but of course there has to be a finding of misconduct. In this case, with respect to the no possibility rule, which has not been adopted by this court, the trial judge specifically found in its order on the motion for new trial that despite Ebron's arguments to the contrary, Johnson was not removed because of her apparently nonconforming view of the evidence. Rather, as I stated in my earlier memorandum, the court's decision to dismiss Johnson rested on two independent and relevant grounds. Her failure to follow the court's instructions regarding the interjection and use of extrinsic information during deliberations, and her lack of candor under oath. Later in that same order, the court again reiterates, Johnson was not dismissed based on her view of the evidence, but rather for failing to follow the court's instructions and displaying a lack of candor. When the court put a footnote in both the motion for mistrial and the order on the motion for new trial, explaining which instructions she thought were violated. There the court said, she mentioned the juror's oath, and then she said the instruction was, anything you may have seen or heard outside the courtroom is not evidence and must be disregarded. You are to decide the case solely from the evidence presented here in the courtroom. The court also mentioned her instruction, where she specifically told the jury, it is also your duty to base your verdict solely upon the evidence without prejudice or sympathy. It's important to understand the context of how this issue arose before the district court. On the fourth day of jury selection, as the court has noted, Ms. Johnson, after the lunch recess, sent a note to the court saying that she was under stress. I believe she mentioned that she was pregnant, and that the other jurors were, I believe, cursing their voices. The trial court, after talking with counsel, said, I'm going to send her a note, tell her to go back in the jury room, because the trial court only accepts notes from the foreman. So she instructed Ms. Johnson to go back in the jury room and continue deliberations. Later that afternoon, the jury sent out a note asking about one other juror being able to go to a children's awards ceremony in the following week. At that point in time, defense counsel said, wait a minute, they're anticipating going on into next week. And so a dialogue began between the court and the attorneys about whether there should be an investigation. It's important to note here, well, that the court was looking at, and it's in the transcript, Mr. Beatty had pulled a few cases. We know that the court was looking at the Edwards case from this court, as well as the Kemp case from the Third Circuit. And Ms. Fardino even mentions, well, I've looked at those cases, the relevant parts of them. And so they're talking a little bit about the law that goes along. This notion of the no possibility rule was never raised during that hearing. It did not come up, and it wasn't argued to the district court. However, when the foreman was initially brought in, during his interview, he mentioned that one juror had mentioned a three-year ordeal with the DA in which they were called liars, even though honest, and it left a sour taste in the mouth of prosecution and prosecution witnesses, and that he believed when Johnson was finally named, he believed Johnson was biased. He also mentioned that Ms. Johnson had mentioned on the record that this was the fourth time that Ms. Fardino, the defense counsel,
Let's deal with the three-year ordeal with the DA.
Yes.
Is that a matter that was discussed in voir dire?
Yes, Your Honor. That is part of the context. When Foreman said this...
So that's not a basis for a lack of candor finding. I mean, she disclosed it in voir dire.
When you look at the context, Your Honor, it is. The way this jury was selected, they came in, all the big panel of 200 people came in on the first day and were given general instructions. And then they were given a questionnaire, a very lengthy one to fill out, which was not shared with other jurors. Each juror filled it out privately and turned it into the court and came to the lawyer, to the lawyers. Then I believe 15 jurors a day were interviewed individually, so none of the other jurors knew anything about it. On her questionnaire, Ms. Johnson had mentioned that her husband had been prosecuted for solicitation. I think I can't remember if it was during the questionnaire or during voir dire, but she said he had eventually pled guilty to a public misconduct. She believed it was a sting, and she also believed that the DA pushed the case because he wanted to practice trying those kinds of cases. Now, after reading her questionnaire, when her time for individual voir dire came, this was explored at length by Mr. Beatty. And during the thing, Johnson assured the court and the prosecutors that she understood that what happened to her husband had nothing to do with this case. She would not let it enter into her deliberations. She wouldn't let it affect her view of the case. And she was convincing enough that we didn't believe we could make a challenge to cause, on her. Quite frankly, had we had enough strikes left, we would have struck her even though she was on the alternate panel. But there were other people up closer up on the alternate panel that we really felt should go first. She ended up being pretty far back on the alternate panel.
Well, I mean, you weren't limited in moving the striker for cause, were you?
After her unequivocal assurance to the court that she would be able to put this aside, the trial team did not believe that they could move the striker.
Well, I mean, I thought I heard you telling me if you had a chance, you would have moved the striker.
But
if you thought you had cause, you would have moved.
If we thought we had cause after hearing her testimony, we would have obviously challenged her for cause. But she was convincing. The lawyers and the judge believed her.
You're saying if you had a perempt left, you would have perempted her.
Yeah, I'm
that's,
sorry.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, we would have. We didn't have.
You didn't think you had sufficient basis to challenge her for cause. Had you had, notwithstanding that, had you a perempt left, you would have perempted her. That's
exactly, Your Honor. And it was a calculated risk, but she was going to be pretty far back in the alternate panel. The problem was there was a delay in between the jury selection and the beginning of this trial, and I think three jurors were lost during that time. So the alternates began moving up, and Ms. Johnson did end up on the jury panel. But irrespective of that, the trial court knew when the foreperson made this comment about the three-year ordeal, about the husband, you know, she knew which juror we were talking about. And she knew that juror had assured her that she was going to put that aside, and yet she was back in the jury room talking about it.
So that could very possibly be the lack of candor.
That could.
Without going into the misrepresentation when she was asked a direct question, when Judge Cohen asked her a direct question about, have you made any comments about anyone else, meaning the prosecutor?
Exactly. Well, and the judge did specifically question her about mentioning the previous legal experiences and gave Ms. Johnson a chance to address that. I'll find that part of the testimony. The judge asked, have you voiced any opinions concerning personal experiences that you've had in the past in the course of deliberations? And juror number 12, which is Ms. Johnson, said, meaning, I'm confused what you're talking about. And the court says, personal experiences you've had with regard to the legal system. And juror number 12 says, I guess that would probably be, if I know what you're speaking of, that would be yes. The court says, all right, what have you said? And she says, I have said that sometimes people want to get on the stand to express their innocence and tell their side of the story. That's what I've said. The court said, all right, well, did you elaborate on any personal experiences you or family members have had with the law in the past? And the juror said, no, that's what I said. And so the judge pressed it. She said, well, that doesn't necessarily mean the same thing. And the juror responded, well, I just said that when we're talking about my husband, I said there was the legal issue with him, and I said, I do know that sometimes people want to get on the stand to tell their side of the story. That's all I said. The court said, okay, well, have you elaborated on the nature of those problems or any? And the juror called her up and said, no. And the court said, are your views up? And the juror says, no. And the court finally said, the prosecution. And the juror said, no. And then the judge asked a question about the personal comments. So the court gave the juror the chance to explain exactly what she had said and what the court had heard from the other jurors.
And you're saying that doesn't say she said, I said something about my husband and his experience?
She, as the court found, she minimized it. And the court found that in her order for mistrial, I believe, as well as in the order of the motion for new trial. The court said she was very hesitating, and she didn't tell me what all she said. Because
so I guess there's disclosure, and then there's full disclosure.
Exactly, Your Honor. And in addition to what the foreperson said, juror number two recalled that one of the other jurors had talked about having holy hell with prosecutors. Juror number three remembered Johnson speaking about problems with the DA. Juror number six said that a juror had commented on the court case that lasted for 3 years and didn't want to see anyone else go through the things that they had been through. Juror number eight said that Johnson talked about the three-year problem with the prosecution. They also said that there's basically no deliberation on Johnson's part. She doesn't want to talk to us. Juror number nine mentioned that Johnson had talked about some problem for 3 years and again, didn't want to see anyone else go through what they had been through. And juror number 11 recalled Johnson talking about how a DA had given them a hard time for 3 years. So the court had heard the specific information, and as the court noted in one of her orders, what she was hearing from the other jurors was a lot more egregious than what Johnson had said in voir dire. And operating on that, the court was accurate. The court's finding that, number one, Johnson had injected, despite her assurances, her personal experiences into jury selection. She had also was less than candid with the court when asked about it. Interestingly enough, Johnson was given the opportunity by Ebron's counsel to provide an affidavit in support of the motion for new trial. And in that affidavit, Ms. Johnson says, at no time did I mention to any of the jurors what situation I was referencing when I said that my husband and I had experienced something which made me feel that two people should be allowed to tell their side of the story. And then she goes on to say, I never made comments about the prosecution side, and I was not negative about any of the district attorneys. So she was given the chance, not under questioning and after reflection, to say what happened. She still says, I didn't tell him all this. And yet the jurors, under individual questioning by the court, were reiterating the same thing. They knew a lot about this. They had to have known it from Johnson. So the trial court's finding on Ms. Johnson, at least with respect to her husband, I'll move to Ms. Thomas about Torino next, were legally relevant because it's under the prior case of this court. It is legally, it is a grounds for dismissal of the court if a juror is dishonest with the court, even if that dishonesty is about a matter that doesn't relate to deliberation. It does have factual support in the record. I believe it was the Augustine case from the 11th Circuit in which the court noted that the judge's discretion on these issues is at its zenith. And this court has reiterated time and time again that as far as the demeanor of the witnesses go and their credibility, that is a call for the district court because the district court is the one there observing the credibility of the witnesses. The judge said in two different orders, I find the other jurors more credible than I found Ms. Johnson. And this judge had a chance to observe Ms. Johnson in voir dire throughout the trial, and then she saw her question. So this judge had a chance to evaluate Mrs. Johnson's credibility, and she found it lacking. With respect to the comments about Ms. Fardino, on the questionnaire, the jurors were asked to list any attorneys they knew, and Ms. Johnson listed some, even people she'd known back in high school. They were also introduced to all the parties and asked if they knew any of the parties, including the lawyers. And she did not indicate any knowledge of Ms. Fardino on either occasion. Yet, the foreperson remembered that Ms. Johnson talked about this being the fourth time Ms. Fardino had rescued someone from death row. Juror number three remembered that Johnson made a comment that Fardino had gotten three people off of death row. And juror number eight recalled that Johnson said something to the effect of Ms. Fardino was a top-notch attorney who had gotten people off the death row. When asked about it, if she made any personal comments about the juror, about the parties, Ms. Johnson said no. And I understand the argument that question wasn't particularly specific. However, once again, when given the opportunity to address this when not being questioned by the court in her affidavit, here's what Ms. Johnson had to say. She said, "I have never performed any research on Fardino about her law practice or her individually. I never had any discussions pertaining to Fardino with anyone on the jury. I recall that there were conversations about Fardino during breaks, but mainly just comments about the fact that Fardino was from Houston when she had introduced herself. I was very aware I could not conduct research on anyone involved in the trial." That's what she said. That is contrary to what the other juror said. And once again, the judge, after reading this affidavit, again made the finding that she found the other jurors more credible than she found Ms. Johnson.
And when was the time frame for the preparation of the affidavit?
The affidavit was filed in support of the motion for new trial. That was about 5 months after the hearing. So it was much after the fact, Your Honor. We recognize that. But it did give Ms. Johnson the chance to tell her side of the story, yet without being questioned. And so we know what she said, even if the questioning wasn't specific enough at the time. Although the trial court thought it would elicit that, and the trial court believed that the question should have elicited making a personal comment about the attorney.
All right, not cutting you off from staying in the merits, but since you provided the invitation, I'm going to accept it to ask Mr. Batty over there, so he feels that his coming here was fully worth getting a few questions. He has any time left, you can come back to it. Why don't you come up here to the mic, Mr. Batty? You're a big guy. I think you can. I cut her off. I'm sorry. Well, you've got your own time.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Well, you can stay there and do it. Ms. Skinner's not. She's not gonna mind.
Okay.
She would like. She'd like for you to have a little extra time to.
I'm sure she would.
To deal with that. I'm sorry. I'm over anxious to hear your commentary here. All right. Going to the point on the Zeidenberg matter.
Yes, sir.
I want to ask why isn't it overkill, but that's a pun that I don't want to do. You've got this evidence before the jury vis-a-vis, you know, the theory of the prosecution, et cetera. To then call the prosecutor from DOJ, who's now in private practice, to sort of wax on not only about that theory, but his sort of personal opinions and intonations about, you know, the gravity and so on and so forth, just struck me, even on plain paper, as maybe being a little bit far. So I'm trying to stay with the connection on the aggravating factors. Just at least help me. I understand the trial judge ruled it was tangentially relevant. I understand the theory in terms of putting Ebron, but he just kind of goes on when he starts giving his personal opinions about what the letters mean and so forth instead of just the letter. So why are those parts relevant to the whole query?
Well, Judge, first off, I didn't get Mr. Zeidenberg here. He couldn't get here fast enough on this case. He felt responsible.
You're defending yourself too quickly, Mr. Hoover. I asked you a merits question, and you're already trying to dig yourself out.
No, I didn't mean it in that way. But my point is that he rushed to be here for this, and I think in a way that comes across in his testimony, his guilt for his role in what happened to Keith Barnes. The fact, though, is, Judge, this entire defense was built around the idea that Ebron had nothing to do with Keith Barnes and Rat Carpenter's case, that it was none of his business, and therefore he never had any motive. He was convicted because the jury, I think, clearly saw that he did have that motive, but the defense never conceded that. They went into the punishment phase, and they continued to try and distance themselves from that motive, I think because they thought it would be their best chance to possibly get some consideration from the jury. So the motive was still in play, and I think it was still important, and even though it was in front of the jury earlier in the guilt part of the trial, I think it was still important for the jury to hear, and I thought it was important for them to hear that the kind of life that Keith Barnes was actually living while he was in the penitentiary, because he had cooperated for the government, and the government let him down. And that's what Zeidenberg brought across to the jury, that this wasn't, that this was real, that this was a man who was having to serve his time in prison like a mouse in a house full of cats. And that's the point that Zeidenberg brought across. Now, it was related to the motive for the killing. Joseph Ebron participated in this killing because he was an inmate from D.C., and snitches in D.C. die.
Why didn't he ask to be put back in solitary in a protected area? I mean, they questioned him pretty strongly about his prior experience and the risk. He said he wanted to participate in the program, so that was the evidence presented to the jury. So it seems to me it doesn't seem that inflammatory. I mean, it almost seems like negligence on Mr. Barnes' part not to be protected. So I don't know why they would use that against Ebron rather than maybe ameliorating the situation, saying, well, hey, you know, he could have protected himself. Seems like it could go either way. I just don't think it's that inflammatory.
I didn't think it was inflammatory, especially when you consider the fact that this jury was about to sentence a man who had committed 3 murders. There's no question that if there was error in this case for this, it was harmless. This man was standing before that jury with 3 prior executions. The victim in this case was killed because he cooperated with the government. He was stabbed 106 times to serve a message to others like him that you don't cooperate with the government. The death penalty was the appropriate result in this case. Zeidenberg, and I'm at fault for maybe letting him go too far, but his testimony didn't have any impact on that jury's decision when it gets right down to it. That's the fact. It wasn't, if it was error.
You tied it to the theory that was already before the jury that they found on the guilt innocence, essentially.
That's what I was trying to do.
And I guess that's where you lose me. It's post-conviction. Motive is relevant, at least on the guilt-innocence phase of the trial. They had determined that he should be convicted. We're at the stage where we're talking about punishment. And this testimony is relevant as regards motive?
I think the motive is relevant, Judge, because it went to the non-statutory aggravating factor of obstruction of justice. The motive was that he killed him because he was cooperating with the government, because he was a witness with the government. That's the notice that we gave, and that's relevant. It's a relevant consideration for the jury if you kill somebody, this is an attack at our entire system. When you kill somebody that cooperates with the government and send out a message that this is what we're going to do, and it's noticed as a factor for your sentencing like we did, that's relevant. That's a relevant consideration, in my opinion, for the jury to have. Now, it may certainly wasn't probably as probative as the fact that he, you know, that he was had committed two other executions before they found him guilty of this one. But it was something I think that the jury could consider. This wasn't just a killing for a dispute or a killing because he owed him money for drugs that were sold in prison.
Well,
this guy was killed because he helped us.
Isn't the jury trying to decide future dangerousness, keep him in prison for life, or give him the death penalty? Isn't that the issue? So if you have a person in jail killing another person, participating in a brutal, brutal assassination, seems like that would be totally relevant to the jury who's trying to determine whether the death penalty is appropriate or not.
I think it was entirely relevant. I think, again, that's why you argue that it's more appropriate than a life sentence, because it was clear that he was of the mindset, as all D.C. inmates are, that if you run across a snitch, it's automatic kill on sight. And if you give him a life sentence, then you're risking that he's going to run right into somebody like that again.
You've acquitted yourself.
Thank you, Your
Honor. On that point, you had to, were you going to argue another point? I expressly wanted to ask about that, but you have other time, so, I mean, you're not limited to that argument. You all are free to respond to anything else that was raised.
I just wanted to say, if it's okay, that during voir dire, I know that y'all appreciate what happens in the courtroom and that you don't actually see it, but I was there, and I looked Ms. Johnson right in the eye, and I said, are you going to commit that you are going to put what happened to your husband out of your mind, and it's not going to have any effect on you when you get back?
Is this in the record, this exchange?
It is in the record. My questioning of her is in the record. And my recollection is that I was pretty vigorous in making her commit to that. And almost immediately, but I think the record shows even before deliberation, some of the jurors said, she's already telling them about this ordeal that her and her husband went through. She lied to us in voir dire when she said she put that aside and she had an agenda and went back and enforced that agenda, or tried to, on this case. Judge Crone knew it immediately. I knew it immediately.
What was that agenda?
Her agenda is that she was going to make sure that there was not a conviction in this case. And that was abundantly clear. It was clear by the responses of the other jurors. It was clear by her demeanor when she came in front of Judge Crone. It was obvious when you compared her testimony from the questions that Judge Crone asked her versus the other jurors. It was obvious that she was not telling the truth. And it was obvious to Judge Crone that she was not telling the truth. And it was a front. It was an affront to the entire trial that she was going back there and attempting to do. And quite frankly, if Judge Crone didn't have the wherewithal and the courage to ask her, then this case would have been a hung jury, and we would have had to try it again. And it was the right decision.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Batty. You have a red light. Ms. Kenner, we thank the government for its side. Ms. Coulthard, you have a vote.
Does the court have any preferences where I begin?
No, go.
Of course, all we have is the cold record here.
Is the what?
The cold record here.
I thought you said the full record.
And the cold record here. But I do think that Mr. Batty's comments highlight the purpose of making the inquiry that I think the district court should have made in this case. And so I want to give you some more numbers. Three jurors, the four-person juror number 8 and juror number 9, mentioned that these jurors were disagreeing about witness credibility and that Johnson believed one witness over the other. If you add to that three The three jurors who believe there were absolutely no problems at all in the jury room, you have six jurors. Four jurors made statements suggesting that Brittany Johnson doubted the government's case, that she questioned the other jurors' versions of facts, she questioned whether something had been proved, she played devil's advocate to the other jurors' positions. If you add to that the three jurors, 1, 4, and 10, who had absolutely no problem with anything that was going on in the jury room, you have seven jurors. Eight jurors told this district court that all of the jurors were discussing the evidence. Five jurors said all of the jurors were following the law. Now, three jurors equivocated. I wouldn't count them in the no column, but they said, well, it depends on how you interpret following the law. Four jurors didn't mention any bias at all. Two of them discussed it very briefly, 3 and 6. And eight jurors didn't mention anything about Scardino. The Third Circuit in Kemp would call this ambiguous evidence of misconduct. And when the district court is faced with ambiguous evidence of misconduct, it needs to conduct an inquiry to make sure that, and I appreciate that this was a long trial, and I appreciate that the prosecutor believed that my client was guilty, but at the end of the day, it was Mr. Ebron's Sixth Amendment rights that needed to be protected. And you don't protect a defendant's Sixth Amendment rights by dismissing a holdout juror. Now, maybe that's not what happened, but there's evidence in this record suggesting that that is what happened, and that's improper. Now, I want to address the comment that the district court made a finding that the court itself had not dismissed Ms. Johnson because of misconduct. I think that's a relevant consideration, but it's a subjective one. The no reasonable possibility inquiry is an objective test. Had the district court applied it, had the district court listened to all the evidence and said, yeah, I have this evidence over here that they're deliberating. I have this other evidence over here of misconduct. I'm weighing it out. I just don't think this evidence of deliberation is what's doing it. Then I might not have this argument to make. But she ignored evidence. She disregarded evidence of deliberations. And not only that, she said she could because she believed she was authorized to under Edwards. So that leads me to my next point. In the first place, we did preserve this argument thoroughly in our motion for mistrial. And remember, the motion for mistrial was asking for nothing different from what we ask at the end of trial. It was simply asking that we start all over again. So there's not really any efficiency concerns here. But during this whole process, Ms. Scardino pointed out to the district court on more than one occasion, and I would point you especially to, I want to say, 5367 of Record 12, where she said, Your Honor, it's very possible that what's going on here is that these jurors believe Mr. Ebron. They 100% believe Mr. Ebron. And the court responded incorrectly, that doesn't matter because if I find misconduct, I can dismiss her. It wasn't a malign comment. It was simply a misunderstanding of the facts as they were evolving in front of the district court. Finally, the basis for the district court's findings on candor are set out on page 881, and I just want to point the court to the fact that the lack of candor was aimed specifically at statements that were made during the juror interviews, not statements made during voir dire. And on that point, while I appreciate that the prosecutor didn't want to waste their peremptories or that they didn't feel like they had a strike for cause, this juror told the prosecutors, I think the state manufactured a case against my husband. Now, she didn't say holy hell, and she didn't say ordeal, but she said, I think the state of Texas manufactured a prosecution against my husband. That's enough notice. If the prosecutor didn't want that juror, that was the time to say it. I understand that the words holy hell and three-year ordeal are concerning, but they're not really, if you think about it, a lot worse than accusing the state of Texas of manufacturing a prosecution against her husband. And that's what she said at voir dire. Does the court have questions?
No. Thank you, Ms. Coulthard. Thank you, Ms. Kenner, Mr. Batty, for your briefing and your arguments. The case will be submitted and we'll decide it in due course.